Welcome to Midrats with Sal from Commander Salamander and Eagle One from Eagle Speak at Sea or Shore, your home for a discussion of national security issues and all things maritime.
And welcome aboard, everybody. I am the aforementioned Sal, along with my co-host, the ever-genial Eagle One from Eagle Speak. We appreciate y'all joining us today for another edition of Midrats, and we especially want to thank those that are with us live today. Because today we're going to have our farewell to July free-for-all, as with our usual free-for-all format, which I'm not sure what the difference is between that and a melee, but maybe it's just to change the words. But we like to keep an open mind, as we do with every show, but on our free-for-alls and our melees, we keep an open topic. So if you are with us live, you can scroll down to the bottom of the show page. That's where you will find the chat room. We're going to be monitoring that during the course of the show. Paul is there, as always. He'll welcome you on board, and if you have some observations that you would like to share or some questions or topics you would like for us to ask each other or to chat about, please put it in the chat room, and we'll do our best to get to it during the course of the hour. And if you're feeling really extroverted and you want to give us what for, you can always call the studio line as well. It will be open. And the call-in number is area code 347-308-8397. And you don't have to write it down because it's right there on the show page. Eagle One, happy Southern summer to you. How are things doing for you today?
Well, it's a good day. We only had heavy rain for a little while. How are you?
See, this is a family show, so I'm not going to use a Navy term to describe hot and humid stuff. But yeah, it's the price we pay for the other 8 months of the year. It's hot and humid. And when we get done here today, I've got to go keep the jungle at bay. So if you don't hear from me again, tell my wife I loved her, but I don't have a defibrillator in the house, but I'll try not to overdo it.
Okay, good. Today has been an exciting week. We had all kinds of exciting stuff published. We had your excellent article on the failure of the institutions, and then we had that Inside the Pentagon report from Politico about the future of the fleet and points made by Deputy Defense Secretary Kathleen Hicks, and people responding to that. And then the Chief of Naval Operations came out with his new navigation plan 2022, which updates the one from last year, about 18 months ago. And gosh, we've got all kinds of good stuff. You know, National Defense Authorization Act has some Asia provisions in it. We got a nice Hudson thing by Brian Clark and Timothy Walton about a plan to achieve naval aviation superiority this decade. And then we've had a lot of pushback from the Army guys. So it's been an exciting few days.
It has. You know, why are they doing this stuff in the middle of summer when you have fewer eyeballs on it, I guess? Or you can say that you're taking advantage of the news gap. But you're right. It was a busy week. I still have not had a chance to dive into the NDAA stuff that I'd like to, because I know there was some really good stuff in there and some stuff that might have your puzzler puzzling. And yeah, between my CNO article, my Hicks article, and the failure of the institutions article, I wrote more than I thought I would last week. But the interesting thing is here, and I think from a substantive point of view, that the order of importance was how I published it. First, I wrote about the article that involved Deputy Secretary of Defense Hicks, who, whether you agree with her or not, it doesn't matter. She knows the environment She knows what's going on there. She understands where her power is. And what I've been impressed with her is she has seen both up the chain, down the chain, and to the side of the chain where there are how can I put this politely? There are gaps in competence that she's able to step into, and she, I think she's fully leveraged the power that she has, and she's taking power from other areas from people who either don't have the capability or the bureaucratic knowledge to be able to use it. And she, for the things that she wants to prioritize and she wants to accomplish in the service of our national defense, whether you agree with it or not, you've got to respect how she's working. Very impressive. You know, we'll see how the results come out one way or another. I think she has some really great ideas. I think some of the ideas I need to think about some more. But she's a very effective Deputy Secretary of Defense, at least from my point of view. And then the CNO's navigation plan, which as especially people who read my stuff, we don't talk about him all that much here on MidRats, but we do. No, I had some serious disagreements with the CNO on a few specific issues, but I tried to give him a clean slate with everything he does. He's a talented professional with a great record, et cetera. And a couple of people send me notes going, "What are you doing praising the CNO?" I'm like, "You got to call balls and strikes with what both you and I have been doing 18, 19 years. I think we both have a good track record of calling balls and strikes, and I think." The CNO's navigation plan, especially the introduction. I mentioned in my post last week or this week, depending on how you define Sunday. I think he could have almost stopped at the end of the introduction. I think it was really powerful. It was judiciously written. It wasn't too wonky. It wasn't 1,001 acronyms and buzzwords spot welded together into a long, long sentence. It was well done. There were a couple things in the body that were kind of, you have to look hard to nitpick on it. I think the CNO and the team that put that navigation plan together did a good job. Whether it'll have the effect that we want, I don't think really matters, but you need to give the bureaucracy and the sailors something to look at and go, okay, we're doing this. This kind of is in line with what the CNO said here. Again, I just thought it was, for what it is, it was a good document. But I think of the three things I wrote, the least important thing was the one that got the most eyeballs, my failure of the institutions post, which has been in draft for a long time. I think I've actually mentioned it once or twice on our shows that I'd eventually pull the trigger on it. And I just decided to do that. And the executive summary of it, and I just encourage folks to go over to, Blogspot or Substack. If you look at it, it's titled Failure of the Institutions. Is one thing we've talked about here for the 13 years we've been doing MidRats is we've always looked for who is going to drive the discussion that our maritime services can get what they want. Get what they need, get what our nation requires them to have. And it was hard to do with the headwind of Afghanistan and Iraq. And Iraq is on the back burner, slow boil in a small pot. Afghanistan, the humiliation was 11 months ago, mostly forgotten. And a lot of people are asking, who's going to lead that charge? And we traditionally look at, when you look at the major navalist, maritime, naval service institutions. People look at the uniform service, led by the Admiralty with the CNO at the top, and then the civilian leadership that they report to. And I think we have enough evidence in the last year that they're not going to push to upset either the structures we're looking for or what's being proposed in line with the revolt of the admirals that we saw in the early days of the nuclear age with the B-36 versus the carriers, where a lot of people put their already full careers on the line and really saved the Navy that we would need in Vietnam especially. And Or Vice Admiral Tom Connolly, who gave up his chance for a fourth star to help kill the F-111 Bravo that's supposed to be the carrier fighter for all the right reasons. That was a more of a singular battle with some good minor supporting characters in the Revolt of the Admirals. But those naval institutions aren't coming to the fore. And then people look for the non-official institutions that we have. And, you know, you can rack and stack, but I like to, you know, keep it simple. So if you look at the two major institutions that are independent, that are, you know, so on the civilian side, not governmental, you have the Navy League of the U.S., who has their new shop that Admiral Fogo has stood up, and they're starting to staff out. They got, I think, a half dozen people on staff now, a variety of roles. The Center for Maritime Security, I hope I got that right, and we had Admiral Fogo on to talk about it, and they're starting to get their footing, but they're not quite there yet. It's going slow, and in some ways, I think his comment about, and we talked about it, I think 2 weeks ago, or maybe last week, that the Navy needs support. It doesn't need oversight, which I think is 180 degrees off in the direction we need to go in, but that's just a personal disagreement. And then you have the U.S. Naval Institute, which is the other big institution. Those two are the lead. And the U.S. Naval Institute, that's not their mission. They, when you look at what they're doing in the public space outside of their publishing house, which is really a separate operation and is really unique, you have internal discussions. They have their maritime dialogue isn't so much of a dialogue as it is an inside shop discussion where you have staff talking to a four-star, a three-star, a two-star, having Nav Air come up and, you know, give you their slide deck. That if people think the Naval Institute is going to really advocate, that's not what they do. They're not going to do that. So if navalists and those that think that the U.S. maritime side of the equation needs more to be able to do what the Chinese are going to require us to do west of Wake if they want to make trouble, where can we turn to? If you're not going to get the argument made by the uniform or the civilian leadership from the executive branch, which I think is fair, they report to a boss too. Their boss doesn't want to do it. They're not going to do it. These big civilian institutions aren't going to do it or may not be able to do it for building reasons for a couple of years, which we may not have time for. Where do you have to turn to? Where is the other institution that has access to levers of money, power, influence? That's Congress, which happens to be the institution that has the lowest competence and approval rating in our country. But to me, having sit on that post for months and thinking about it, it wasn't a happy answer on my part. It was an unfortunate answer, but I think it's realistic that the only solution that those who desire a greater maritime capability relative to what the Chinese are building west of Wake, the solution, whether you're talking about big issues like updating Goldwater Nichols or minor issues like getting money for shipbuilding, it's got to be in Congress, it's got to be bipartisan, and it has to be sustained. And that's where I think our efforts will go to. And again, that was the least important because it was mostly just my ideas. Like you, I'm an opinion blogger, and I have opinions and put them out there. But it had 9 times the normal number of unique eyeballs looking at it than a normal piece of writing I do. It had 72 shares just on the Substack side of the house, which tells me Blogspot probably had round that up to 100. I usually get 5 to 12 shares on an average post. And I had people from active duty enlisted to retired 4-stars drop me a line to bring up a point or two. And the only real negative impact I got, and I'll apologize to people who took it this way, would be the picture I chose for it, which was I did a Google search for asleep on watch, asleep on the bridge, asleep on duty. It was something like that. And that was one of the pictures that came up. I wanted to get a picture of somebody sleeping over on the starboard bridge or something. But that's what came up. It was just a bunch of midshipmen sitting there asleep. They're not identified as Naval Academy midshipmen. I don't mention the Naval Academy anywhere in the post. But, oh boy, some people really got touchy about that. It's like, so if I hurt any Naval Academy feelings, I'm not sorry. My intention. It's just a good picture. I did have one mid-grade officer reach out to me that I've known since this individual was a midshipman. And they said, those were my plebes, LOL. So that individual found humor in it. But anyway, that's kind of what I wrote about this week. I just think what was interesting, and maybe it tells something about the environment that we're in, is people are most interested in looking for some institution or some leverage that can make things happen, can get us off this place that we're constantly in this, we're in this loop where we have problems, whether we're talking about maintenance, whether we're talking about numbers, whether talking about flop sweat on round two of a war game because all of a sudden we don't have any logistic ships left, that people want an institution out there that can help move the argument because it's not happening with the usual institutions we've relied on. So I think I've used up my too much of a quota at the start of the show, but that was an outline of the stuff that you were talking about.
Yeah, I'm looking back at how do we get people to the American public to appreciate what the Navy does for them, and you know, you have to almost go back to the Reagan years when John Layman was Secretary of the Navy, because that's where the 600 ship Navy and a lot of the decline that followed the Vietnam War began to be dealt with. And Layman was in the Secretary of the Navy's office for what, 6 years? I mean, he was that we need that long-term leadership. We need somebody who's willing to go out and push. The thing, and I guess the good news for Layman was that he had a president who was supportive of growing the Navy, and you know, the other things that made some sense, the home porting ships in various areas instead of the fleet concentration points that we have now, you know, all that stuff went away. But I'll give credit to Jimmy Carter. Some of the things that we saw that improved the Navy came up during Carter's period in office, and they just didn't come to fruition until after he left. But you know, you need a strong advocate. You need somebody who can sell the Navy to Congress, and you know, impress them with, if nothing else, with Congress. You've always got, you know, they've got to give their voters something to chew on, and you got to follow the money. So, you know, the other day I saw that John Conrad or somebody was talking about the $1 trillion that the Secretary of Transportation is getting, you know, and I'm thinking, well, yeah, that's great, but, you know, obviously some people would like to put that into the MARAD, maritime shipping stuff, but, you know, how much do you think that's just going to go to local the politicians for contracts for road building and all the other stuff that they promised as to rebuild America's infrastructure, including bridges and all that other stuff. So, you know, the point is that if you're going to have somebody who's going to be strong, he's got to be able to sell the Secretary of Defense and the President on the need to develop the Navy. And I, as much as I don't know much about the current Secretary of the Navy, seems like a decent human being, but good gosh, we need somebody who's more than that. We need a vigorous advocate, and you almost have to go back to the days of Teddy Roosevelt and Mahan, when, you know, the Mahan book, Influence of Sea Power on History, was a hot topic and was read widely and all that. And then, you know, the fact that Theodore Roosevelt and Franklin Roosevelt were both assistant secretaries of the Navy. I mean, that went a long way to their being willing to help the Navy expand during the times it needed to expand.
And I tried to be nice to the SECNAV. I think he's a nice guy. He's a great professional. He's an accomplished man. And I remember when we talked about him before, and I had always said that I always wanted a SECNAV, and I still do, somebody who preferably I think coming from Congress or somebody that knows politics, knows people, can tell, you know, which rib somebody's itching on so they can scratch it, can get things moving. And because of his history and fundraising circles with the Democrat Party, I say he's not an elected politician, but he knows the people, he knows politics because he's very successful at what he had done. But I think another part of that of being political is, especially with that background, you're a foot soldier. You aren't a leader as a fundraiser, and that's his background. So he's going to take his marching orders from above, and he will loyally execute that as much as he have. You're right, we need a different personality in there, and preferably somebody that has the top cover to not quit in disgust or be fired quickly from doing it, because you have habits have been developed over time and are reinforced by statute and tradition that's going to make us very hard to break out of a template we've had for decades. But it really, when you look at the challenges west of Wake, it's clear it's a maritime and an aerospace battle. I did get a kick. I saw on Twitter, I think it was maybe Charlie that put it out there, that the land forces were having their meeting in Hawaii. And it was beautiful. It was a backup picture of the middle of the Pacific with Hawaii in the middle and the globe. It is all water. It's like, yes, please let the land component talk about what they need in the Pacific right in the middle of the big blue. A little tiny brown dot in the middle of the big blue. I still don't think a lot of people really appreciate, you know, what we're looking at there. But that's okay. That's quote, our unquote job. I mean, you and I are two little ants running around the forest floor, but a lot of people need to have the conversation just to keep educate and motivate each other to keep this conversation going, because it's not going to happen on its own.
Yeah, and I think what I just put this in the comment, the chat room, but everything we've talked about in the last few weeks is the fact that we need an overarching maritime strategy that encompasses the Navy, the Merchant Marine, the Marine Corps, and things like the Air Force. The Air Force has at least one asset. I think it's the B-1 bomber that can actually fire anti-ship cruise missiles. We need to get some of these other – and when you're looking at doing stuff these days, and that Hudson – Institute Regaining the High Ground. Let me see if I can put that in the chat room, if I didn't already. They have some pretty good charts in their work. It was Brian Clark and Tim Walton about the ranges of what China's got and what the effect that has on where we can actually place our forces west of Wake. And you know, it's not a pretty picture. It's and when you're don't have the long range assets when your major carrier aircraft is an F-18, whether it's the Super Hornet or not, it doesn't have the legs to go the distances that are required out there. So the refueling from a drone, great, but there are a whole lot of other issues. We're going to need some major shore-based assets to come help us out at sea. And that article by this Regaining the High Ground Against China, it really does discuss that. It's kind of interesting. I'm not thoroughly familiar with it completely, but I'm going to read it in great detail in the next few days. But, you have to be cognizant of the fact the world has changed. These anti-ship cruise missiles, these long-range things, even though missiles that can wipe out bases on Guam, and I don't know what kind of salvo, I think we had a discussion about this, what kind of requirement would it take to fight off a determined attack against Guam. It's a struggle, and we need to really take a hard look at what we're going to do and how we're going to do it, and that's the fleet. There was a pretty good article in Proceedings by a young ensign, which I'll dig up here in a minute, but, his argument, again, is the same one that some of us have made, that we don't need a fleet of super large ships. We sure do need a lot of ships, and the more ships you have, small, big, cheap, I don't care if they're carrying the U.S. equivalent of the club missile from Russia. You know, make it a targeting issue. And use your small ships to fight those gray maritime forces of the Chinese. We need presence, and we need a lot more stuff than we have. And you can do it on the cheap. We've had many discussions about how we can do that with less money than buying a couple of billion dollars destroyers. But we need to get moving. Somebody needs to start pushing the go button and demanding that the Navy move forward with these things, and it doesn't have, you know, it's like the old John Wayne movie, they were expendable. You know, we have to recognize that sometimes we're going to put people in harm's way, and they're not going to be in a position to perhaps to come back from it. And that's no different really than flying a fighter plane or any other kind of aircraft into harm's way. We just have to kind of treat some of these smaller ships sort of like a fighter plane.
Well, let's I'm going to pull something up that you and I talked about in the pre-show that I think folds in pretty well with that. And it's also one of our favorite topics here, the unsexy but important. And one thing that caught my eye is we brought online hull one of our new oilers, the USNS John Lewis class. And when I said, oh, let me pull it up and just look at it for a little bit. And two things stuck out at me. First is we're building six. I'm sorry, that's not enough. I know the accountants can tell you it's enough, but if you want to have a war-fighting Navy, you're going to need more than six of this class. That's the first thing that popped up in my mind. And the second thing that came to mind is they talk about how it's wired for CWIS or CRAM, and it has some crew-served weapons, which means probably just 30-caliber machine guns or maybe some M2 50 cals. To decorate somebody's bridge. But it had me think to, I think, one of the great fighting ships of World War II, at least for me, was the oiler, the Neosho. And for those that are familiar with the Battle of Coral Sea, that ship and the two walking wounded, I think it was two or maybe it was one, anyway, destroyers that were with her, because the Japanese reconnaissance plane just saw a big ship and said carrier, but they put up against that carrier air wing that came after them thinking they were U.S. carriers, you know, made the difference in the Battle of Coral Sea, and they don't get enough credit for the battle they put up. But you look at the Neosho, that oiler at that time was, you can find slightly different numbers here, but she had 4 5-inch guns and an equal number of 20 millimeters. Roughly, she could put up an anti-aircraft capability comparable to somewhere between a destroyer escort and a no-kidding DD. Our oilers need that capability fast, as in bolt, plug, and go. But I don't know whether CWIS and CRAM would meet the modern 21st equivalent of that type of anti-air defense with a lot of the weapons you've talked about, and maybe we can talk about some of the other lessons that are coming out of the Ukraine conflict. But I would be really curious what it would take to get at least ESSM, the Evolved Sea Sparrow missile capability, quad packet, you know, how do you bolt that or get that type of capability inherent on that type of ship. Something more than a CWIS or a CRAM, because especially, and I know our friend John Conrad is in the chat room, we talked about it when we had him on board here, is we know very well, in case the balloon goes up, is we're sending those ships and other ships west by themselves. That's just the plan, because they don't have a choice. And they've got to have a greater inherent ability to defend themselves. So I would love to sit down with the engineers for John Lewis class and say, hey, how would you do this? Tell me why you can't do this. And I know there's some legal issues as well, but you've got a background on those types of ships. You know, what are your thoughts about that? Is it something that is desirable, needed, or do you think from a ship alt point of view, they could be upgunned like that? Which, by the way, one of my pet peeves is, every war we've ever had, one of the first things they learn in the first few months is our ships don't have enough weapons.
Yeah, it's an interesting problem because when I was on an ammunition ship, a U.S. Navy crew manned ammunition ship, we had, I don't know, a couple hundred, close to 300 sailors on board, I think. And, you know, the military Sealift Command takes over a ship like that, and they'll put 123 crew on there. And, you know, but our crew was, first thing is when we got busy, and I put up a Twitter thing on this, when we got busy, it was 24 hours a day for bursts of time, maybe a week. You'd be out, you know, rearmed destroyers during the day and carriers at night. And so your crew was worn out pretty quickly. And that was with, you know, three times the number of sailors that the MSC has. Now, the MSC people are professionals. They're good at their jobs. They don't waste a lot of time and effort on things. But, you know, many of them are specialists. So if you need people to man gun mounts, you're going to have to add a military debt. I mean, some people call them armed guards and all that stuff. And if you're going to add that, then you're going to have weapons that match the threats that you're going to face. You know, are there – is – when you're running a ship from – Hawaii to Guam, is your threat long-range enemy air coming out of China? And, you know, I have questions about that. But what about, you know, what kind of escort force you have? And you know, the MSC people and some of the other shipping people have already been told, you're on your own. Well, that doesn't make much sense. But, you know, you can't have a supply train that is going to be interrupted by a submarine sitting off Hawaii. I mean, that doesn't make any sense. You've got to have something better than that. So you need an escort force, and you need weapons on those ships that are capable of dealing with whatever the potential threat is. And then you're going to have to man the ship to the level where you have enough people to do that sort of job, and it gets interesting. So I'm, you know, and I put up a table on Twitter, but it came from a 2005 study, I think, that CBA somebody did. You know, an oiler in the Navy had 324 crewmen, and the civil MSC crew was 106 with a 21-person mil debt. Ammunition ships, 413, yeah. Navy crew, 123 civilians, 40 people in the mil debt. AFSs, now a lot of these ships have been combined now, but AFSs had 486 sailors, 135 civilian sailors when MSC has them with a 49-person mil debt. And the AOEs had 583 crew members and Navy crew, and were manned by 160 civilians when MSC had them with a 28-person mil debt. And I don't know if that mil debt includes on the AOEs the air debt that we put on there. So it's a challenge, and I think John is noting that the MSC people are having trouble getting civilians too. I mean, it's for their ships. So, you know, there's some real issues here about the size of the Navy and the size of the logistics support force that we need and how they ought to be manned. And it's a difficult problem. But again, you need somebody who understands these issues, an overarching military and maritime strategy that covers all this ground so that, you know, you don't have the right hand not knowing what the left hand is doing or coming up with a whole different naval maritime strategy than the one that we're trying to use to support our fleet and our country.
Yeah, and I'll be the first one to make snarky comments about Twitter, but it all depends on how you curate your timeline and your feed and who you block and who you mute and who you follow. But I initially just grinned when I saw it, and we talked about it briefly on a couple of shows here the last few months. But it's really making more and more sense. And one of the best extended threads I've seen, and there were a few other players that came into it, but the major players was Sal Marcogliano, John Conrad, Blake Herzinger, talking about how you would put together a maritime department. Because the people who right now have the responsibility for the care and feeding, selling and defending of that capability have failed. I guess that could be a follow-on failure of the institution's post on there. But I have to study harder for that one than the other one. That it's you want to call it criminal, but it's not criminal. It's just entitled negligence is one way of looking at it. And it's along those lines of, you know, one of the reasons why I did the failures of the institutions, because you have these accumulating problems that if you believe, that I do, that we have a window over the next 3 to 10 years of having a confrontation with China in the Western Pacific, unless we just walk away from it, that there are certain things that we can't waste another decade fiddling around. And just like before World War II, those armies that paid attention to the lessons of the Spanish Civil War were able, in half a decade or so, to be able to shape their military forces and their plannings to accentuate those lessons that were learned imperfectly and not directly, but that were learned during the Spanish Civil War. And that popped into my head this weekend when, for those that are monitoring it, the Russian headquarters, which, by the way, I think were Sevastopol is probably on the same latitude as North Carolina. So I guess they're kind of like coastal Carolina, so maybe off on the Grand Banks type of climate. It was Russian Navy Day, and all appearances are that the Ukrainians decided to spoil their Navy Day, and they hit the Russian Navy headquarters to wake up the staff weenies. And it had me thinking that a lot of the things that have developed recently, and recently could be a few decades, that the Ukraine-Russian conflict, not just on land, but at sea, is tapping us on the shoulder and telling us this is what y'all need to be ready for in the big war that's going to come. Long-range precision fires have completely changed the definition of what a rear area is. What is the range of those weapons? What's their circle error of probability? And if you're under them, like most of our fixed positions are from Guam West, you can't make assumptions that they're not threatened. And how do you mitigate that threat? I think that everybody who can is going to try to build or buy or borrow or steal something that has the capability of an ATACMS, which is the single, for those that have been following the Russia Ukrainian conflict, you have HIMARS, which is the wheeled vehicle that can carry 6 normal-sized missiles, and the M270? I could be wrong there. The tracked version can carry double that number. However, the HIMARS, it's so big, and it has that 300-kilometer-plus range that a HIMARS can only carry 1, and the larger tracked vehicle can just carry 2. But everybody's going to want some type of capability like that and more. The Chinese have it in spades. I don't know what their circle area probability is, but numbers can do a lot for you in that area. But they're going to want that capability. How do you defend about that inside of 300 to 500 kilometers of where your enemy can get to? Are you configured for that? Do you have the ability to put them there? And there's also the issue of the small to large drones, whether you're talking about that commercial quadcopter that can drop a couple of hand grenades in a solo cup, or the ones that have repurposed some old Cold Warrior-shaped charge warheads that you can have something the size of a 16-ounce Coke that can destroy a tank. To the larger drones, I know before the Russia-Ukrainian conflict, we talked a lot about the Russian electronic warfare capabilities. And again, who knows what information we have behind the cipher door on this skiff about this. But obviously, the electronic warfare is not being effective all over the place because both sides are using these drones to great effect. And a lot of the problem is that, and again, I'm sure there's stuff in the skiff that can give you a nice graph of this, but I think it's clear and obvious that we have developed our air defenses, as has everybody else, against relatively, even with stealth, relatively large cross-section, fast-moving aircraft and missiles. How do you adjust those logarithms and sensors to be able to deal with smaller, slower, lower items? Will you even see them? If you do see them, is your warhead able to take them out? I think that's that challenge of how you take those things out of the sky as opposed to letting them hover over your trenches without opposition. That's a big challenge. And I think we're going to learn more. We have, what, about 90 days till winter normally sets in there, maybe 75 days, that the bow wave of Western weapons is just now starting to get there. So by the time winter hits, you're going to have more Western capabilities there on the front. That'll be interesting to see for those that are tracking such things. But that's something we've talked about over the years in the challenge in the Western Pacific, that it's a small blessing for us that we've seen what's happening in the Russo-Ukrainian war in that area of long-range precision fires, that hopefully we got smart people and good jobs with a funding line that can get us ready for that. Because when the big war comes, I think that's part of the tranche of known knowns that are really going to come out in sharp relief, except we're going to be on the receiving end.
Yeah, and it's the same problem we have successfully avoided over a huge number of years of going up against shore-based capability, anti-ship missile capabilities. And, you know, fortunately for us, at the time, the Iranians and the Iraqis did not have really good systems. But all that is getting improved. The Chinese are helping out. They've got these, you know, we saw it off Israel with the C, was it 801 or 301, whatever that missile is. And, yeah. So, you know, we have to, we know that this is going to be a problem. We've known it for a long time. The naval, we have people warning us for years. Don't put all your eggs in one basket. Stop building these huge ships that carry everything. We've probably beaten that horse to death, but we continue to. I don't understand the amphibious configuration that we think we need. I don't know how much of that is driven just by the Marine Corps history and how much of that is actually a need that we have. You know, I don't want to question all that completely, but I am fascinated by the fact that somebody now believes that we ought to use our amphibs to provide underway replenishment capabilities if necessary. Well, I'm thinking, well, I remember the amphibs just sucking up fuel and driving around in diamonds because we weren't doing any amphibious landings. And if you're going to do amphibious landings, how are you going to do that in a contested environment with all these anti-ship cruise missiles and stuff? I know brainier people than me are working on this, but I just have trouble wrapping my mind around how that's all going to work in a truly contested environment.
Yeah, I think when you war game that out, the answers are troubling. you got to find some way to unclassify these uncomfortable conversations, because sometimes fear and shame are great motivators. But if fear and shame never makes it out from behind the door in a way that can get capability and money behind it, then all you do is, when everything blows up, is people come out of the woodwork and go, I told you so. But by then it's too late. There's got to be some action on that front. And I want to bring up one little item, because, you know, we've been talking about some TV stuff here, but short of an actual war with China that I don't think anybody wants, I sure don't. If that never goes hot, never goes kinetic, as the cool kids like to say, we will continue to compete with them, not just economically, but for influence, for position, for shaping the international order in one way or another. I know that gets some people excited, but I'm sorry. The world is going to have to decide if they want an international order shaped by America and her allies' worldview, or a world order norms and processes based upon the People's Republic of China and Russia's worldview. because they're really the only friends they have are each other. The North Koreans, I think they all hate everybody, but you know what I mean. And one of the disappointing things I saw today is word is out that Speaker Pelosi, who was supposed to go to Taiwan, that she won't be making that visit, that word got out that she was going. There was much kerfuffling in the kerfuffle zones, and the Chinese gnashed their teeth and rend their garments, and that succeeded, we think, in Pelosi not going, which is unfortunate because Speaker Pelosi has a very commendable history here. And back in 1991, this would have been just a couple of years after the massacre of Tiananmen Square. She and a few of her colleagues were visiting Beijing. They went to Tiananmen Square. And there's video of it. You can look it up. She unfurled a banner on Tiananmen Square in honor of the Chinese protesters who were slaughtered there. And, you know, had the Chinese police come over and raise all holy hell with her. So I think that probably, I put $20 on it, Speaker Pelosi's desire to go to Taiwan is consistent with her history. And if she's not going to go there, it's because the Secretary of State and the National Security Advisor had the executive branch push back on her. I think it's a lost opportunity. And the best thing, whoever was responsible for leaking that should probably be tarred, feathered, and run out on a rail, because the greatest effect with the littlest blowback would have been if she just showed up. There she is in Taipei. Nobody can complain about it. Nobody can do anything about it. And if the Chinese are smart, they wouldn't say anything about it. But because they had an opportunity to make a public spectacle, if they could make Nancy Pelosi step down, they can make Nancy Pelosi and the United States lose face because the Chinese pressured them. It was an alpha move on the Chinese part, and if we give them that victory, then bad on us. But the best thing would have been for Nancy Pelosi just to show up there, do her thing, and leave. It would do great things for the Taiwanese. It would have sent a great message to our friends and friends adjacent in the area, and it would have tweaked the communist Chinese, which is always fun. But as opposed to having a light win at that point, if Nancy Pelosi, while she's in the Pacific, follows through with what news reports had today and does not go to Taiwan, it's a great victory for the People's Republic of China. And in my opinion, the United States has been damaged by us, and in essence, backing down because people said grumpy things. It was unfortunate.
Yeah. You know, I don't think our politicians understand the concept of face as it plays out in the Far East. I mean, everybody kind of, well, yeah, I know what face is, but I don't think they appreciate how important it is to, if you're going to be the defender of all that is right and true in the world, you got to live up to that. You cannot back down in the face of somebody going, well, we're going to rumble, you know, make loud noises, and worst cases, you know, we could send airplanes up and blow your Speaker of the House out of the water. You know, and a lot of it, too, the Chinese, I don't think, understand it. Or maybe they understand, but they don't really grasp. Is that a distinction? Anyway, they don't get where her role is. You know, President Biden cannot tell her what to do. He can't tell her not to go. He can't tell her, you know, it would be uncomfortable and all that stuff. But it's you know, she's the leader of, or the majority leader of the House of Representatives, and that's a whole different ball of wax than somebody in the Biden administration, although they do share a common political party. But you know, that's not the way the Chinese are organized, and yeah, but if they, yeah, anything they can do to humiliate the U.S. or make the U.S. back down, and we've already given in a number of ways, you know, by doing these freedom of navigation things instead of, which is good. They're better than doing nothing, but there's a lot of other things we could be doing out there that we discussed with on recent shows. You know, putting assets in place to strengthen our allies' ability to resist Chinese influence. But the minute you back off a little bit from resisting that influence yourself, then it's not a good thing and not a good picture.
Now, and here's along the lines of that information war, public affairs, maybe a little bit of psyops thrown in there here and there, but something that was bothering me, it just, when I was working out in 100-degree heat, I'll blame the heat and humidity for my brain clicking off on some things, so that's okay. That's why I beat myself up outside working. It's good therapy. But one thing that came to mind is, and I almost don't want to mention it because it's a punchline to a joke, but it's a very real thing. What has been seen cannot be unseen. I almost don't want to mention it because I don't want people to look it up because I know some people will, but yeah, we're all adults here. One thing that came out last week was a absolutely hellish video of something that men have done to each other in combat from time immemorial, but we only recently had the ability to capture it. The Russians mutilating, torturing, and eventually executing a Ukrainian prisoner of war. And that's not the only isolated incident. There's also some indications that some of the Ukrainians that surrendered in Mariupol were executed or killed in mass. Same thing, really. For those that know that area of the country, I mean, there's a great book out there called Bloodlands. It's whether you're talking about the Mongols or whether you're talking about the Waffen SS and the Einsatzgruppen or the Stalin's commissars and their starvation in the 30s. I mean, that whole area has a very, very thick nerves in history of just horrific, horrific stuff that only shows up periodically in other parts of the world. But in the Bloodlands, in that part of Eastern Europe, it's very regular. But that's not the only example. And where is the Western human rights lobby? Where is the peace protesters? Where are the huge marches in London and Berlin and Rome and everywhere else that we always saw, not just during the Cold War, but during the Iraq invasion? We've seen a couple of small things, but they're not there. And I've had my own opinion of those people for a long time. I hope more and more people realize what those organizations are, what their real motivation is, because they're nowhere to be seen, and that's just everybody should understand who those people are and what they are, because it should be clear now. It's just disgusting.
Yeah, don't mince words. You know, there are people, their fronts paid for by the very people, very same people are carrying out these atrocities, and they have been. It is a way of mobilizing, giving the Western world, a bad look because they're protesting against this stuff. And well, you know, for years, probably before, maybe even during the Korean War, you know, they're a third front. You have to, I know, it's a front. Don't tap the sign. It is a front you have to fight, and it's been sponsored and paid for by people in Russia and in China, for that matter. So, you know, if you have a human rights violation in China, and you can, which basically is the whole country is a human rights violation, but, you hear about it in certain areas, but not in and the mainstream press. Every now and then one story will break out above all the others. Tiananmen Square is an example, or what they're doing to the Uyghurs in China. But it doesn't stay in the press very long because there's an influence at work there, and it's an influence that involves money and Lord knows what else, but there's some kind of pressure being brought. Well, it's the same thing that's gone on with the downplaying of what the Russians have done in Ukraine. And the Ukraine has its own issues, and they're pretty good at this public affairs stuff, but you know, nobody's hands are clean in warfare. I hate to tell anybody this. You know, I was reading about Agincourt the other day, and you forget that Henry captured French soldiers to be executed because he didn't want them behind. You know, they had to have somebody guarding them, but the French were still coming at him, so he didn't want to have to face a force from behind. So he had a lot of these people executed. And, you know, that was the reality of war then. It's the reality, and then, you know, a lot of the other realities that we still see going on in places like when we were in the former Republic of Yugoslavia, you know, the rapes, the whole process and the way war has gone on is not ancient history. It is yesterday's history and today's world, and it doesn't get reported enough, but it exists. And yeah, those people who used to march, they're you know, you know exactly who they are. They are the socialists and we love Russia crowd, and there's a Ukraine, we love Ukraine no matter what crowd too. So you just have to be real careful about how you look at this stuff, because it's going to go on, and you're right, it is warfare.
Yeah, it's you know, one of the interesting things is you always have to be careful is an interesting point where there are good people, well-meaning people that just happen to think of things from the different side of the political spectrum. And one of the funnier things that we've seen, and has actually gotten some traction internationally, is NAFO, the North American Fellows Organization, which is a bunch of people who've gotten together to help buy equipment for the Georgian Legion, which are the Georgians fighting for Ukrainian. And they do a bunch of memes and the little Shima Ibu puppy dog characters that you see, and they've raised some good money. But what's interesting about it is you have people who you would normally define as left of center, and you have people who you would normally define as right of center, but they've all kind of come together to support that organization. And there are people on the far left that by their silence speak pretty well. And there are actually some people on the right side of the spectrum that seem to be Russian apologists that is interesting in its own. But that's one of the interesting things, is there can be occasions that step up where well-meaning people, on at least our domestic political spectrum, when they get together like that, that's usually a good indication that it's a decent cause. But I think one of the great – and we can blame COVID a little bit, but we'll see in the fall – when there's no excuse, because most universities are going to be back full in the fall. They really were last year too, but they really will be this year, is, you know, where is all the peace, love, and understanding civil rights people that would march so readily in our college campuses? You don't hear from them. And I think it has a lot to do with what you said before. But that's just the time we live in. I just think it's important to, when you get a chance, to go ahead and point that stuff out. Somebody's got to say it, and sometimes you just don't notice it, but you got to mention it.
Well, you know, you got to watch out for me. Having been involved in the great Vietnam War stuff, I haven't seen a Jane Fonda movie in 40, 50, I don't know how many years, a lot of years, 50-some years probably. So, you know, I don't understand how she got away with what she got away with, and you know, I know she's apologized sincerely, I'm sure, about that. But good gosh, somebody going to, of course, you know, part of the problem is we never really declare war anymore. So, you know, well, I was just there visiting. I didn't know anything was going on.
Yeah, at least we don't have anybody doing that. The thing that still leaves me to ponder is I don't think we're going to get anything else now that the NDAA is out of D.C. And we had an election coming up in November, so all the politicians are doing what they need to do between now and November. And I guess we'll have to figure out what's going to happen after the election. Everybody says there's a pretty good chance that the House will flip from the Democrat to Republican control. The Senate, I think, is a coin flip for a variety of reasons, but again, not my area of expertise. And I was trying to think, okay, will this really make a difference for what we've been talking about for this entire episode? And I don't know. It's not clear. It's not obvious. Like, there are some other, you know, political issues that I can draw a pretty sharp line that it'll make a difference. And then when the new Congress steps in, we already start the campaign for 2024, and so that's going to mud things up. But one of the things that's been nice the last couple of years is we did have a knowledgeable and impactful member of Congress from the Democrat side of the House who was very, very engaged. That was Representative Luria from Virginia. She's got a pretty tight race. If she doesn't survive the blue wave, you know, I'm looking around on the other Democrat side of the House who has her knowledge, her passion, and her ability to work responsibly and trustworthy across the aisle, which is a reputation I think she's justifiably deserved, because regardless of who's in power, you need both parties to do that. So again, the question you and I have asked people for years, it still goes back, who on the Democrat side of the House are going to help us push? Because something this important cannot be a partisan issue. And that will be something I'm sure we will talk about in the fall and working into the winter time about in the maritime side of the national security arena, where are positions and players going that might be able to move the needle in a direction that we think it needs to go. I don't even have a clearly laid out plan A, B, and C on that right now.
Yeah, I think it's just that the task ahead. I feel like Sisyphus. You start looking at the task ahead looks so large that because we 20 years really of neglect of the Navy and the fleet and yep. Maritime community as a whole that it just makes me shake my head. There's a lot. Big uphill climb here, and it's got to be funded. And you know, funding is driven by every ship has to have at least one component made in every single state. So we just need some really serious adult leadership in the Senate and in the House of Representatives to lead on. And we've fortunately had some good people in the House speaking up. I don't think I've heard too many senators jumping on this bandwagon yet, but we need at least a couple.
Yeah, well, we'll always find out, that's for sure. But again, another quick hour of maritime excellence. I don't know if we solved all the problems, but we pointed out a few that I'm sure will be folded into other conversations as we go forward. So that brings July to an end. I guess August is a kickoff, so everybody will be, that have kids, will be focused on getting them in school. The Congress critters will be crittering around, because I think people used to say that the real hard stretch starts after Labor Day. I don't think that's true anymore. It goes earlier than that because of technology, but we'll just keep plugging along here.
Yep, that's all we can do.
That's all we can do.
And
hey, everybody.
And we just ask our listeners to keep plugging away with us.
Amen. We've got some great, loyal listeners, and pass the word. And speaking of which, I always like to do this when we have our melees and our free-for-alls. If you've made it this far past the hour, that means you like Midrats, you like listening in here. If you haven't already, go over to iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts and give us a 5-star rating. Tell us how wonderful we are and how great our sound quality is. And don't give us a 4-star, give us a 5-star. That isn't because we're needy, which we might be, but it's what that does is when other people want to get a podcast that concern U.S. Navy or maritime issues, we will continue to pop at the top of the search items, and that'll bring more people on to listen to the podcast. So if y'all could do that for us, I'd greatly appreciate that. Until then, I hope everybody has a great Navy Day, and we'll check you on the next podcast. Cheers, everybody.
Molly wrote a neat reply to Irish Paddy Old, saying Mike Maloney wants to marry me, and so leave the Strand and Piccadilly, or you'll be to blame. For love has fairly drove me silly, hoping you're the same. It's a long way to Tipperary, it's a long way to go. It's a long way to Tipperary, to the sweetest girl I know. Goodbye, Piccadilly, farewell, let us swear. It's a long, long way to Tipperary.